Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. This is Westchester on the Level with your host, Hezzy Eris.
Good morning, everyone. I'm so excited. Today is Friday. It's June 25. It's 10 o'clock on the Eastern Seaboard. And what I'm excited about, besides the date, which is nice, and the weather looks good, except for the weekend it'll get hot, we're speaking to, of all people, the esteemed and the very well-respected Nader Sayers. She's the New York State Assembly member representing District 90, which is confined all within Yonkers. I think 75 or 80% of the city is represented by you, Mr. Sayers.
Yes, Mr. Hezzy, 75% of Yonkers is part of the 90th. But the good thing is my entire district is Yonkers, unlike other assembly
right.
members that have multiple communities. So it's for me, it's great. I can represent the city I love 100%.
Well, you know, you don't need to be deflected. You know, so many communities. There's enough to do here, I think, in Yonkers. We're a big
exactly.
challenge, in a good way.
Well, Hezzy, it's
this
a pleasure
has been a
to be
very
back
successful. Yeah, well, this is a very successful year, despite it originated from the worst circumstances, which was the pandemic. But now
yeah.
with the infusion of new funding that is coming into place with under Biden's administration, the federal government, it has been redirected. The money has been directed to the state of New York and other states as well. But then once it reaches the state of New York, it gets dispersed throughout the state. And how did Yonkers do? How did Westchester County do with respect to that?
Well, we did very well. You know, all of us were aware that, you know, with the pandemic and the economic crisis and the closing of businesses and unemployment, there was a lot of serious concerns during the last year and a half. And those of us in government, really at all levels, local, state, federal, the focus was how do we reopen the economy? How do we get people back on their feet? And a lot of it was through either state or combination of state and federal funding, the stimulus funding provided by the federal government. Yonkers, Westchester, New York State, we did fairly well, you know, billions of dollars were allocated. We were fortunate, as we said on previous shows, to have the majority leader of the New York delegation in Washington, Senator Chuck Schumer. And you know, when it comes to Yonkers, when it comes to city funding, when it comes to Board of Ed funding, you know, at least for the next 2 years, you know, we're in good shape. And you know, and that's because of the federal and the state funding. But as I always say, Hezzy, you know, 2 years is around the corner. And my concern as a legislator thinking ahead, what do we need to do to make sure that once the federal funding, you know, is eased off or we begin to lose that federal funding, you know, where do we go? Do we go back to square one where, you know, there's still that inequitable funding formula? So I have legislation in Albany to fight that and to really change the way the state funds education, which in my opinion very strongly is very inequitable for Yonkers kids and Yonkers schools and funding. So, you know, so yes, we're very happy. We feel there's a sense of stability. The vaccination numbers have gone down tremendously. And, you know, so the process that we planned for early on as far as vaccination, as far as getting to the 70% threshold, as far as herd immunity, all that seems to be working. Plus, you know, we're in summer now, and the weather is nice, and people are not getting sick for colds and spreading germs and so forth. So all that contributes to some sense of coming back to normality. We're watching basketball games and baseball games
yeah.
and concerts are opening up. And, you know, some people are still, you know, taking, and we encourage a continued focus on safety, You know, I still wear the mask whenever I can. And honestly, in some circumstances, you know, when we're celebrating, whatever, you know, we start going back to the normal days. And, you know, so you got to be, you got to kind of walk a fine line. You know, you got to appreciate that, you know, we're safer, that we're reopening, you know, and promoting normalcy. But at the same time, I tell people, you know, continue to be careful, continue to wash often, continue to every now and then use sanitizers. And, you know, and when you're in a crowd where you don't know who the company is, you know, do wear a mask because you never know. Those of us that are vaccinated feel a little more sense of security, but still you never know who's out there, who's not vaccinated and who may very well still have the virus, you know, so we got to be very careful.
Absolutely. When you look, this is, I remember when you first ran for office, one of your biggest goals was to try to come up with a plan with regard to educational funding that was not specific to Yonkers, which I personally had always felt was the reason we lost out and we weren't heard. At the state legislature, because they say, oh, it's just about Yonkers. Why do we have to worry about them? But your focus has always been to try to bring everyone under one tent, because if we have equality and integrity in the way we create the formula, then everybody will do well. Maybe not 100%, because maybe there's a limit to how much money there is. But as you've always pointed out, we have a very aging infrastructure, a very old.
Yeah, we do.
Some of the schools are over 100 years old. And, and we don't have the ventilation that's important, you know, in order to keep safe. That's one of the biggest issues for especially old infrastructure. And that costs a fortune of money. That's about the only remedy you have until you build a new structure. I've been reading about that of late. So how does it feel when you speak to your colleagues in the assembly? How do they feel about the education formula? Are they comfortable with it? Because there are a lot of communities that are short-shrifted.
Well, you're right. And, you know, most of my colleagues, when I speak to them about the inequity in funding, of course, they're very concerned. And when you bring up the issue of the New York State funding formula, honestly, many of them were unaware. You know, they just anticipate that the state has a process in place and they tend to feel it should be working and it's probably working well. But when you get into the details and you start explaining, you know, how wrong it is and how other communities, other states have initiated revisions and New York State has not done so, they become very concerned. And when you start telling them it's a statewide issue that impacts not only Yonkers, but communities all over the state that that are wrong, then they become more concerned and they accept, you know, being a co-sponsor of my legislation. And, you know, just to your point, you know, during the pandemic, the biggest issue in having our kids return to school, to schools for learning, was to make sure that there was proper ventilation, there was proper, you know, cleanliness and safety precautions. Mm-hmm. And sure enough, you're right. In school districts like Yonkers, where the average building is 80 years to 100 years old, that's a serious problem. You know, ventilation systems weren't efficient. And then to do renovations similar to the state funding formula, that also impacts what the state gives districts like Yonkers to renovate and build new schools. For many years, similar school districts like Buffalo, Rochester, Syracuse, they were getting 98 cents on a dollar, whenever they build or expanded or renovated their schools. Yonkers for many years was getting 50 cents on a dollar. So if it costs us, you know, $3 billion to build the schools we needed and we pushed in that direction, you're talking about $600 million that, and more, that we had to come up with you know, to where the taxpayers can't even afford that. So we're like stuck. And I'm saying, in addition to improving state funding for, let's say, schools like Yonkers through the funding formula, we need to put equity into the building of schools and the renovation so we can put new vent systems, we can put new safety precautions, we can modernize our buildings with internet and technology so that in the future we don't have to scramble, you know, as we did the last year and a half here in Yonkers. So, you know, and to your point, the funding, for example, formula as it is now, puts a lot of emphasis on the wealth of the county and the community you're in. Mm-hmm. And in a community like Yonkers, for example, you know, property is very wealthy, and we know that. But then you look at the population of students, kids we serve, and 80% are on free and reduced lunch. So one of the biggest components of my funding formula changes or revisions is to make sure that the new funding formula puts more emphasis on the percentage of students in your district that are on free and reduced lunch. In my opinion, that's the best indicator of the wealth of the kids that we serve. That's more practical. Mm-hmm. And when I told my fellow legislators across the state how simple it was, everybody agreed that the federal government for years has used the free and reduced lunch criteria to determine, you know, the status, economic, social demographics of a student population. So the bill calls for all school districts across the state that have a 60% or more of their student body on free and reduced lunch. And I think it's fair. I think it's practical. I've spoken to members of the federal congressional delegation that also agree. And also, very interesting, Congressman Jamal Bowman, who I've had discussions with on this matter, is pushing for legislation on the federal level that takes away wealth, the wealth of property in a community, you know, as the determining criteria or factor. So, you know, so it's pushing in the same direction. And that's part of what we always speak about at the show, that there needs to be more and continued collaboration, discussions between local government, county, state, federal, because legislation, you know, takes place from different angles. Sometimes, you know, people on the federal level see a law change in New York and they say, wow, this is really meaningful and it's good. And God knows New York has taken the lead on many fronts to really promote new legislation. And then before you know it, some of the congressional people or U.S. Senate people start sponsoring similar legislation. Also, from my end, we sometimes see legislation that was passed in other states, in Texas, California, New Jersey, elsewhere, and we say, you know what, we don't have that in New York. And I don't mind saying, you know what, I'm going to take that piece of legislation and sponsor it in New York, which we've done. So the process of government has to be open-ended. It has to be across different levels of government, as long as it addresses a basic need or concern that our constituents have. Sometimes it impacts my constituents in Yonkers, sometimes statewide. Sometimes it becomes, you know, something that resolves an issue nationally.
You know, that's what impresses me about your capacity, which I hadn't seen before. And that is that, well, not only are you have a learned background, an educated background, and you were in so many different aspects of government in Yonkers, including the Board of Education and as a lawyer and so many different fields of expertise. But when you went up to the New York State Assembly first term, what you were able to do is you maintained your inquisitiveness, your interest, your compassion, and your study. And just to be able to recognize what's going on in the entire nation and to say, well, I wonder if this will work for us, is just breathtaking. And also refreshing, because we don't normally have that. Or maybe other people do the same thing, but we don't know how they came up with these concepts. But, you know, you're man enough to say, hey, this is a great idea, and I think it needs to be replicated here for Yonkers and for the state. Now, one thing that you brought up originally, and you said that you're concerned about what's going to happen 2 years from now, and is one of those possibilities that will respond to that something that we have here in Yonkers, which is the casino, the Empire City Casino? Does that look like we might be able to move that forward and get it approved for gaming online? Because I think
you pointed out
that so many of our
MGM,
people.
You're right. MGM, you know, in addition, you know, to state and federal and changing the funding formula, I always felt very strong, even when I ran first in 2018. You know, MGM, Empire Casino, Yonkers Raceway, to me, you know, that was a crucial issue impact in our community. As you know, MGM is one of the largest corporations in the world, and MGM choosing the Yonkers location, which is in my assembly district, you know, to me, has a tremendous impact, not only on educational funding, on business development, on the economy, on job development. I was impressed with the level of payment for various jobs and careers that MGM was paying. And all of them were really terrific jobs where people can raise their families and live in Yonkers and the Bronx and Lower Westchester. This is really a regional impact. You know, people don't realize Yonkers schools are receiving for many years $19 million. And in the last state budget, there was an attempt to reduce, take away $1 million, which we really fought against. We fought against, and they restored the $1 million. But I want to go a step forward. I have met with representatives from MGM and others, and we said, you know what, let's make sure that MGM is made whole. And made whole was to grant MGM downstate licensing. You know, we know that, you know, sports betting and table gambling is going on in states around us in New Jersey. We started to do research and found out that New Jersey, for example, 40% of the revenue that is derived by New Jersey on sports betting is from New Yorkers. So, you know, the point was, why do we lose that funding? You know, so we know that if MGM is given the downstate license, which we lobbied for very hard this year, you know, unfortunately, there was an issue with how many licenses are given and so forth. And the word is that within this coming year, I strongly believe that the governor would agree along with the legislative body, and they would agree to grant MGM the license. That would really energize our regional development. The impact on Yonkers, on public education is tremendous. We already had unofficially commitments that may bring an additional $10 million of revenue over the $19 million to the Yonkers public schools. So that's part of dealing with what I consider a structural problem that public education funding has had in Yonkers for 50 years. And this is real concrete effort. As a legislator, as someone who's an educator my entire life, as someone who served as a trustee, and now as a public official, you know, I'm looking at all angles. And I'm saying, you know what, there's a problem here. Let's resolve it. Let's, whether through legislation, whether granting MGM a license to do table gambling, and to look at all avenues, you know, to change the way we fund building new schools so that we can have the capacity to really house all our students, all our programs, our music, our art. Mind you, I know as a principal many years ago, because Yonkers is one of the few cities in the state that continues to have a growing population, when other communities like Buffalo and elsewhere, they're losing their population.
Yeah.
And the sad part about it, over the last 10 years, God knows how many new schools and additions they built in these communities, that part of them are empty. Meanwhile, in Yonkers, We can't build new schools. We barely have enough money to renovate and put extensions on existing old buildings, right? And then there's a problem where we still can restore, you know, full music rooms like we had 40 years ago, or art rooms where you can have in each school building an art room or a full gym. Now they're using gyms where they're cafeterias, they're gyms, you know, they have multiple use and so forth. So you can't have a gym program or a sports program, you know, that's ongoing. Depleted playground yards and, you know, the lack of air conditioning where students sometimes in June and summer programs can't even learn when it's 100 degrees inside these old buildings and so forth. Yeah. Or in the winter, the lack of proper heating equipment and boilers and so forth. So, you know, you need as a legislator to really have the experience, you know, to have been in this situation. And I can say, hey, as a principal, as a trustee, as a parent of kids, yeah, I had the experience. I knew what it took not to be able to have an art room for my kids in my school, or a music room, or to split a nurse between 5-6 buildings. How can you have a nurse when a child is hurt, a teacher, a staff member is not feeling well, there's an issue, well, you got to wait for a nurse to come from another school and so forth. So hopefully with the additional funding, with the restoration of services, you know, we can at least feel good about our kids being in a safe and a very viable learning atmosphere where they have all the, not only academic, but all what I consider the supplemental necessary programs and services our kids need. Support services, for example. Yeah. Excuse me?
I want to ask you about something that's related again to the casino. Do people recognize that the viability of the casino is not just for just for the city of Yonkers, but it covers the entire Westchester County and even beyond? The impact, financial impact of the money that it can develop and grow.
Sure, of course.
And then what's going to happen with Mr. Pretlow? Because I hear that Mr. Pretlow will not be running for an additional term. I think next year will be his last year in office. And isn't he the head of the wage department? I don't remember the exact name.
He's the chairman of the racing and wagering committee.
Right.
And it's an important committee in the assembly that oversees or really in control of legislation that deals with racing and wagering. So that's really racing and sport betting and betting process that impacts MGM and other major casinos across the state. Assemblyman Gary Pretlow is the chairman of that committee.
Yeah, is it conceivable that if, since he's not running again, he may change his mind, you never know, but should he stay, that would be great, but if he doesn't, is it conceivable that you can beseech the assembly for you to get that portfolio?
Well, you know, Gary Pretlow is the expert on racing and wagering, and honestly, I haven't heard that Assemblyman Pretlow made a decision not to run. I haven't heard that.
Maybe I'm wrong. I thought that's what he was doing. Okay.
No,
it would be great to have him.
Definitely. But, you know, like I always say, I made it my point, being that Yonkers, you know, MGM and the Raceway and the casino is in my assembly district. And although we've always had a champion in Assemblyman Pretlow, as chairman of the committee, but, you know, I wanted to be on the committee, and I reached out earlier to the speaker and said, hey, you know, this facility is in my district, and although we have Assemblyman Pretlow, of course, you know, I'd like to be on the committee. And sure enough, I was put on the committee. I'm very grateful for that. And again, as I always say, you never know what the future brings you, Hezzy. So for me, if opportunities arose in the future, of course, you know, all options are on the table. And, you know, but for now, I haven't heard other than the assemblyman will continue to be chairman of the committee, and I haven't heard anything contrary to him staying and running again. But, you know, he's there now for 2 more years. So, you know, it's not even something that...
Oh, he's got 2 more years, which is even better. You know, it's even better.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like I'm looking to see him go. When I heard that what I thought was correct, that he might be leaving or not running again, maybe. So maybe it was just this is going to be his last term. So if he's got 2 more years, all the better. But we got elected in November, a member of that portfolio.
Yeah, no, it's a pleasure to be on the committee, and I think we all recognize how urgent MGM, as you said. I mean, not only Westchester County, we have a lot of support from the members of the Bronx delegation because the impact with jobs and careers and funding for the Bronx is crucial. And even the legislators in the Bronx realize that, hey, you know, so many of the employees at MGM are from the Bronx. They live in the Bronx. They work in the Bronx. So, you know, so I look at it, as you do, as a regional impact. Of course, representing Yonkers, it happens to be in Yonkers. So we look at it as something that, you know, we take more pride. And fortunately for us, when, if you recall, other communities in the state, you know, turned away, you know, major business advancements. You know, we in Yonkers embraced MGM, you know, but we did it in a way where, you know, we made it clear, look, we want business development. We want businesses to come to Yonkers. It enhances our tax base. It enhances job development and creation, economic development. But at the same time, we've always been advocates for a big business. Fine, come to Yonkers, come to our community, but you must work with us. You must work with the community, with the labor force in our community. This way, there's a balance there. Similar with UPS, if you remember. UPS is another major business that on Tuckahoe Road and Grassy Spring came. There was community concerns. I joined the community in basically saying to UPS, hey, you know, it's great. You're coming in. You're renovating. You're expanding in Yonkers. But, you know, don't forget about the community when it comes to traffic, when it comes to trying to make sure noise pollution or other items that impact the quality of life. And then realize whenever there's an expansion of major business, there's also, you know, major development, construction and renovation.
Mm-hmm.
And sure enough, we realize local labor forces, like labor 456 was protesting and, you know, lobbying against some of the UPS projects where outside labor was being utilized. So we reached out and had some consensus through communications, through dialogue, through negotiations, and said, wait a minute, you know, we can't blame local workers. Why are you bringing trucks from Ohio and Boston and Pennsylvania and elsewhere because it's cheaper labor? You know, you have labor here locally. Maybe it'll cost you a couple of bucks more, but doesn't it show more good faith to work with local labor and have labor and people that live in the community feel good about, you know, jobs staying here, utilizing local workforce? So that's part of the role of looking at an issue, trying to say, hey, what are the positives out of this? Where are the negatives, and how do we get it to work well, where people can join together and say, you know what, this is good for the community, this is good for the business, because let's face it, a business is not going to come to a community if it's going to be given a very difficult time. And we also know when
what I never understood is that every time we're looking for workers in construction, they do come from out of state, Connecticut, Pennsylvania, New Jersey. And I never understood the value of that, because even though they may be less expensive for the development overall, it costs more money for the city, because at the end, the people who may work here take the money home wherever they go, and they spend
That's
it
right.
there. We don't get any benefit of it.
No, we don't.
The only one that's making a benefit out of it is, I guess, the developer who's putting
exactly.
it up. The point is they can pass along the cost to the market rate housing that we're building, or even affordable housing components.
Well, that's,
you know, these things are not discussed well.
But you're right.
People don't know.
To your point, even, you know, we spoke about UPS and outside businesses, but also I sponsored legislation that deals with, you know, whenever we have storms, we have hurricanes, we have major problems
mm-hmm.
where there's utility
yeah.
or electric outages. My legislation in Albany, you know, aside from what the Public Service Commission was supposed to be, a agency that oversees a lot of what happens with public utilities, you know, gas and electric and other type of utilities.
They don't do a good job of it. They don't,
well,
they
yeah,
don't oversee,
you know why?
It well.
Because the same thing we saw, I noticed that when there was outages, and now we know in the Northeast and other parts of the country, but here in our locality, it's almost a given that every year there's going to be a storm, there's going to be outages.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we're now demanding through legislation that utility companies, you know, show a little more respect for customers, show a little bit more care for doing more proactive initiatives. For example, one of the bills deals with making sure that within a set amount of time, for example, 24 hours, utility companies must restore power, for example, to police, to fire, to emergency services, you know, by making sure that they have backup generators. Imagine a police department or a hospital or an ambulance service or an EMS or fire department that doesn't have power during an hour because, you know, these utility companies want to save money or they don't want to have backup generators. That's nonsense. So through this type of legislation, that assures that. Also, I've noticed when there is outages, right, and trees fall on wires and lines
mm-hmm.
and you need repair trucks to come, right, I've noticed, again, trucks that are coming from other states that take
from
days
Louisiana.
To get here.
Yeah. They come from
it takes
Louisiana.
Days and
take
sometimes
them 7 to 10 days to get here.
Exactly.
And how much does
oh,
that cost?
Cheaper.
And what about the food that gets spoiled and the medicine that gets thrown out?
Exactly. Or people that are on you know, health machinery, you know, should
yeah.
they lose electric service? Should these companies, utilities, have the names of every customer that is, let's say, for health or medical emergency needs, is on a medical device that needs utility service
mm-hmm.
and energy to make sure that these individuals, you know, have a special plan in place? Or to make sure that they utilize local labor again and not to save a few dollars, to make sure that they automatically give credit to customers that lose service. You know, now the process is, as a customer, you got to wait. You're billed for the time even though you don't have service. You know, you have to argue with them. You have to make an issue with them. You know, it should be mandatory.
Mm-hmm.
They should,
well,
they
remember,
should automatically
it was last
give you
year,
credit as a customer.
It was last year, I remember that for the first time, people who had medication that needed to be refrigerated, but because they lost power, it spoiled and you couldn't use it. And then there was
correct.
Food that got spoiled and had to be thrown out. And it was interesting because they had been, Con Ed, for example, had to pay for this sort of stuff, spoilage, in New York City, and it took years for them to catch up in Westchester County. I think it was only last year for the first time that it came into effect. But there's something
right.
wrong with this whole process where we don't move ahead collectively. And New York City, of course, has got, you know, a need, but then so do people up in Westchester. I mean, we're not chump change, you know. We pay taxes.
No, we're not. We sure do, and, you know, we spoke about, you know, New York State budget, $212 billion. You know, we're able
amazing.
To increase education by over $29 billion. So you know, to the point we made earlier, you know, we it looks like we're in good shape, as I said, for 2 years. But, you know, and but my concern is with all the funding we put in for mental illness programs, you know, for after-school programs, summer programs, you know, so things are looking good. And, you know, and recently, last night, attended my brother's keeper. You know, there was a golf outing the school system had, and there was a lot of support. And, you know, it's good to know a program that Yonkers set the model. This was through the Obama administration. President Obama had even recognized Yonkers, New York as being, you know, the model for my brother's keeper program, which really provides a lot of support and services, motivates, you know, young men of color, and really motivates them to have mentors and have a drive to succeed and go to college and promote careers. And I'm impressed with the effectiveness of a program. So, you know, from the state level, we funded it so that other communities across the state can utilize the same. But, you know, my concern is looking forward, you know, to issues involving disabilities. And, you know, yesterday I had my disability liaison, Carol Conklin, come to my office, and we spoke about, you know, the American Disability Act, and they're celebrating, I think, the 37th year of the passage of the act. And, you know, at the state level, you know, this last session, we passed so much new legislation dealing with addressing the needs of the disabled and special schools for students with special needs. And me being appointed this year as chairman of a subcommittee under the Education Committee dealing with students with disabilities, you know, I've taken an active role in trying to reach out, get a list of all agencies and schools that deal with students with special needs, and to really start bringing people together to very soon hopefully hold the roundtable, you know, public forum discussions here locally and hopefully across the state, that really for the first time start pushing an agenda where, you know, whether it's to making sure there's proper funding or supporting the agencies that provide the services or making sure, you know, organizations like Elizabeth Seton Pediatric Center that serves, you know, students, young people with serious medical conditions, to make sure that these individuals, even after they pass the age of 21, are allowed to stay at a facility. And then when I look at the research where a lot of these young people that are getting great care at these pediatric type of institutions, you know, are forced to leave because these institutions get less funding after the age of 21, and so these individuals got to go to adult-related that are not as safe and not as efficient. And then you find out many of these young people end up dying, you know, dying because there's a change. Then you realize as an educator how we push and support special ed students, you know, throughout their public education, for example. And then we give them a special high school graduation degree, and we let them go. And then very often you realize many of them that had the safety net in, let's say, a public school setting, right? Now they're out there. Mm-hmm. They don't have job development skills. They don't have the support services. And, you know, many of them become homeless. Many of them, you know, have mental or other emotional disabilities along with physical disabilities. And the system doesn't have in place a safety net to assure some sense of continuation. Yes, we have some services, but it's not up to par. You know, I've reached out to local agencies that provide jobs and careers to people with disabilities, and we've honored some of them as agencies of the month and really tried to motivate them and see ways to enhance their funding. But that's what it takes. It takes looking at the big picture, you know, whether it's dealing with homelessness or whether to deal with mental illness or people with disabilities or education in general, you know. And that's how you tie in the MGM and you tie in the business development and you make sure that, you know, although we want to fund all these social service issues and social agendas, you know, to do that, you got to make sure you have a thriving business community in our state and our community. That's why when
it was very interesting. I was reading that Biden was able to pin down a $1 trillion cross-party spending package for development and funding for infrastructure. So that would require a lot of people to get trained in order to develop the infrastructure. Is that something that we have an impact with, you know, as through state funding that comes to the state? Are we going to be able to retrain some of our people who don't have an earning wage?
Has anybody who's a student, of history recalls, the New Deal? And through the New Deal, through, President Roosevelt back then, we came out of the Depression and we're looking at ways. And this pandemic in many ways is like the period of the Depression. Yeah. People were out of work, you know, economies were destroyed and so forth. And sure enough, at the time with the Tennessee Valley Authority and all the development projects through the New Deal, the whole emphasis is, hey, let's get America back to work. So they put the fund in. The initiative through the New Deal was to build schools and build bridges and build roads and railroads and hospitals. And really that whole initiative was basically to say, you know what, you want to put the country back to work? Let's develop all these projects, not only for work development, but, you know, every 50 years, you know, roads and bridges and dams and, bridges, everything you need's repair. So sometimes, we wait too long. For example, now, you know, through this infrastructure, you know, we can start paving roads all across Yonkers in the county. We can, for example, the Soymil River Valley needs a lot of repairs. There's a lot of entrances and exits to highways that are still dangerous that we can repair. We can make sure, you know, every veteran post, every school, every public building, every senior citizen center, that they have elevators, that they have handicap accessibility. This is all part of projects where, you know, you put people to work, you address basic needs, you know, you see job development, economic development. You know, that's the way to go. That's part of what this Biden plan intends. You know, it's really another New Deal for America post-pandemic to really get America back to work. And part of that is to making sure there's proper funding. The biggest problem now, many people, for whatever reason, are not really going back to work. You know, the minimum wage in New York has been increased. Now the concern is, you know, how many people are accepting jobs. You know, ranges between $14 and $15 in New York State, depending on the region. And that's good. You know, so I'm glad that there is an increase, because now people can actually begin to reach some sense of stability where it makes sense to work. Because honestly, and we saw that as an issue, if you make, you know, give outs too easy, unfortunately, many individuals through unemployment and stimulus funds and so forth were basically saying, hey, why should I go to work? You know, why should I go work as a busboy, as a waiter, as a short order cook, as a taxi driver, whatever the case may be? You know, many individuals, you know, said sit at home and getting paid as much or more made sense. So now business people are having a hard time, because now we're saying, hey, you can open up your restaurants, you can open up your theaters, your sport complexes. Now they're complaining.
But those people that were earning less than $14 or $15 an hour, they weren't getting a large benefit from the federal government, were they?
They were in many cases.
They were earning more than $600 a year a month.
Sure, between unemployment, between between the federal stimulus funds, they were seen. But now the federal stimulus is out of the picture. So now we got to compare what they're receiving from unemployment and from other benefits. Uh-huh. Many individuals, for example, through the rent moratorium, even though the legislative end of it, you know, rightfully so, really wanted to avoid homelessness. So there was a moratorium against evictions. But, you know, it worked well
for many tenants.
Yeah, that's coming to an end. But it worked well for many tenants that had COVID, that lost their jobs. But there was many out there that said, hey, the government said, I don't have to pay rent. So even though I may still be working, even though I never had COVID, but the government said, I don't have to pay rent, so they're not paying rent. And even though we have legislatively provided funding to make sure that people can apply to pay back rent, the sad part about it, many people just sat back and said, you know, why bother? Which is really a shame, you know. So if the funding is there to say, hey, I owe my landlord, you know, 6 months of rent or sometimes over a year of rent, let me participate, let me apply for the funding, you know, that goes to bring my rent up to date, then of course the landlord, you know, once the moratorium is out of the way, the landlord will say, hey, I don't need to evict, you know. I got my back rent. We can continue back to, you know, some sense of stability. And again, avoid homelessness. You know, the package is well-intended, but, you know, I always say as a legislator, you know, you always have to fine-tune the criteria. You got to make sure that conditions and criteria are such that people know their responsibility. And there's always clauses in there that really tell an individual, hey, don't do anything that's fraudulent, anything that's illegal, because you know what? You're going to be held responsible. And unfortunately, we're finding this, you know, with unemployment claims. How many people were applying unnecessarily? How many people were stealing other people's Social Security numbers and filing for unemployment? There's major investigations throughout the state, a lot of fraud, you know, and that's what happens when government quickly goes into a program, doesn't put the proper safeguards, and they allow people, you know, to, well, the initial intent was let's not make it difficult, which I respect and understand. Let's make it easy during difficult times for people to get the funding they need. So that, you know, that is well intended. But I still say, you know, unfortunately, there's so many out there that if there's a way they can abuse the system, let's abuse the system. If they can take advantage of the system, let's take advantage of it. And that's what concerns me, the amount of losses with federal funds and state funds. And really, it causes the whole trust system that we've had in place in America for many years to help those in need, you know, but to verify that they're really in need. You know, my concern is too many people are taking advantage and too many people, you know, have taken this as a norm. Well, hey, everybody takes advantage, so why shouldn't I? And that's one of the problems with our system of government. And maybe some people don't want to hear that, but that's the truth.
Well, it is the truth. I never understood why you could help people out at times of need, but at the same time, that there are ramifications if you undermine the system and fraudulently take what isn't yours. And we have and always hear from government, oh, they have an oversight committee for this, that, and everything else. But at the end of the day, nobody ever looks into anything. It is absolutely outrageous with the amount of fraud that's going on.
Well, also recently, you know, through legislation we passed in Albany, the governor signed Safe Staffing, impacting Safe Staffing. This was something nurse associations across the state and here in Westchester and Yonkers lobbied for. And I was happy to co-sponsor the legislation the governor signed into bill. And what it does, it establishes clinical staffing committees in each general hospital to develop and oversee a safe staffing plan. So I'm glad for that. And one of my colleagues, Eileen Gunther, was the sponsor of that. She's a nurse herself for many years. So that's what it takes. It takes individuals, you know, in government that have experience in areas, those that, for example, have experience in law enforcement, you know, try to really provide the rest of us with good initiatives for, you know, effective policing strategies and, you know, initiatives for transparency and training. And in this case, this is a fellow legislator who is a nurse for most of her career and was able to say, hey, this is what happens when, you know, there isn't proper funding, administrations at hospitals have a difficult time. And what happens, you don't have enough nurses on the floor, ICU or safe staffing, and that in turn, patients are not given the proper care. And we've seen, especially during the pandemic, how many patients, God forbid, passed away. And a lot of it really was because there wasn't around the clock proper monitoring and care. And, you know, and that's the type of thing, whether it's looking proactively, you know, at education, at homelessness, looking at healthcare and nursing, looking at ways to enhance development and the economic base. You know, I was very concerned when many were pushing to tax developers and landlords and investors, you know, to the point where already we can't put the brakes on how many are leaving New York State, how many are saying, look, if you continue to overtax us and make it extremely difficult, why should we build in New York? We'll go build in Florida and Texas and Carolinas. And I was able to see that, and I was able to say to people lobbying for an enhancement of revenue that, yes, we agree that we need to enhance revenue, but let's do it in a way that's fair, that's equitable, that takes into consideration all the players and the constituents, so that at the end of the day, you know, it's fair, where you can tell an investor, look, you got to pay more of your share because, you know, government and services cost us more. But at the same time, yes, I understand you need to make a profit. And I understand, you know, if it's not worth your time, why should you? So, you know, that's thinking beyond the box. That's having a broad perspective of your community and what the needs are in your state, because everything interlinks. And but these type of shows, Hezzy, allow us the opportunity to talk to constituents, to really give an update on what's happening with legislation, what's happening with the pandemic, what's happening with the state of vaccination, what happens with all these issues with police reform and you know, now bail reform and parole reform. And these are debates, many of them, that are still continuing. You know, we just legalized marijuana. It's taken almost a full year to say, let's put in place a process to assure that at least we proceed in a fair way, that, you know, it's not a mess out there, that it doesn't impact us in a negative way. So as a legislator, you know, you look at legislation we passed, you look at legislation that's still in the works, and I myself, you know, even with the police reform, have met with police commissioners, law enforcement officials, and trying to listen to the victims of crime and their families, for example, that are very concerned that, you know, when we push with new initiatives involving reforms and parole and less is more legislation that deals with, you know, various initiatives that either seal or expunge criminal records or allow, you know, minor, you know, parole violations, you know, not to get to jail, for example. Some of that I understand. You know, a lot of people are saying, you know, if you've done your time and you're on bail, you know, you're on parole, why should you be thrown back in jail for something so minor as missing an appointment? And some would argue and say, well, what if somebody repeatedly And yes, the law requires that if you show, you know, a serious crime or you do the same type of negative conduct or repeated violations, then of course you should be given jail time. So these are the type of issues that, you know, are still on the table, you know, but they got to be well thought out. We can't rush into them like we did with bail reform, where we had to go back to the table and revise again. So that's what these type of discussions is what helps me as a legislator to really understand, you know, how I should vote and how I should react, and what can I do to promote more communications.
You know what I don't understand about, you know, the people who commit a crime, much of it has to do with their lack of financial capacity. They don't have a job, and they're hungry. They have no food, and or they may be homeless, or all kinds of things that cause these issues, or they're exacerbated by it. And yet, you know, keeping someone in jail is a very expensive prospect too.
Why don't we
change the prison system where we can teach them how to get a job?
Well, Hezzy, to your point, I mean, you're a man of vision, and you know, one of the major legislative pieces now we're working on is what you're talking about, to revise the jail system so that not only, you know, is it now legal or proper for the jail institutions to have proper medical care and health care at the hospitals. So many prisoners, you know, some of them, you know, for whatever the wrongdoing, have medical conditions. They, you know, they need medication for heart disease, for diabetes, for other conditions. And it's terrible. The lack of proper health care is a serious problem. And now there's legislation that's passed that allows or mandates that jail systems, you know, if you're a criminal and you're in the process of release, right, they got to make sure there's extensive planning to make sure that, you know, when you're released, there's planning to assure that, you know, you're not homeless. There's planning to assure that, you know, you're put into some career path as far as if education is needed, if counseling, you know, is needed, or there's mental illness and there's emotional distress or other factors, that they hook you up to services provided by the counties and the state, and to avoid homelessness. Because as you said, to your point, you know, when you're released from prison and you have all these issues and concerns and you're on the streets again and you don't have a job.
Yeah, and no job.
You still have a drug addiction or you have a mental illness,
right,
and you don't know where to go for counseling. You end up committing crimes again. You know, so for some criminals, maybe that's a safe haven. You know what? Nothing's going on. I'm hungry at night. I have no place to sleep. Maybe I should go back to jail. You know, so
that's what they do.
Yeah. So, you know, so legislation, you know, was passed. You know, David Weprin, who's chair of the Corrections Committee, has been in the forefront of lobbying for a lot of initiatives that, you know, reform jails and reform the services that the inmates receive. And honestly, I've supported a lot of that. And, you know, so I do recognize that, you know, once somebody does their time, you know, give them the opportunity to have a clean slate, give them an opportunity to get back on the right track, you know, and with strict compliance, commits a serious crime, that, you know, they would be held accountable. Has he?
Oh, yeah, hold on. I think I made a mistake of some sort. So bear with me a moment. I don't know what happened here.
Take your time.
Okay,
Hezzy.
Hold on a second. Okay, that's what happened. I'm going to put you on hold. Okay, sorry, Mr. Saez. Sorry about that.
My pleasure.
Well,
no, my pleasure. Well,
so,
you know, a lot of good things are happening.
I think so. Very, very good. Well, thank you for making the time as usual, scintillating, rewarding.
Always a pleasure.
Hear you. And,
it's always a pleasure. Thank you for all
thank
you,
you
do.
Thank you very much.
Keep it up. Enjoy the weekend.
All the best.
Bye-bye.
You too, sir. Well, there we have it, folks. New York State Assemblyman Dr. Nader Sage, Esquire as well. He represents District 90, which is terrific. Well, let's bring in none other than Richard Thomas, the former mayor of the city of Mount Vernon. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, Hezzy. I was hoping that we would get through today. We've been having some challenges of my cell phone calling in, and I'm hoping that we can have a great talk today, catch up on weeks of stuff that have backed up and piled up. But I was hoping I could call you from a landline.
Oh, you can. So you want to give that a shot?
Yeah. Is this the best number to call you, the 3471?
Yeah, 347-205-9201.
Yeah.
So 347-205-9201. Then I'll hang up from the other number. Okay?
205, what was the last four?
347-205-9201.
And I think it's ringing.
Locked.
There it is.
Welcome to Block
Finally in.
I don't know if we're in yet. Oh, there you are now. Okay.
Hey.
Hold on a second. Can you hear me?
Absolutely.
All right, then great. Then you're in. This is fantastic. Boy, the genius of modernity. And so sometimes it works, but rarely.
That's right.
Well, you know, I don't know what you want to talk about, but probably the most compelling thing is that we just finished a primary. The tallies have come in. They're so close in Mount Vernon. It's like, oh, my God. Sometimes less than 100 votes separate those that will get back into the city council and those that may have already lost by their 50 or 60 vote differential. And there are a whole bunch of new people. What happened?
You know,
the old seem to be thrown out.
Well, the race in the elections that just happened, they're not done yet. They're in court. And it's my understanding that Caitlin Gleason, who was leading Andre Wallace by, let's say, 100 votes, she's now ahead of him by only, I think, maybe 20 votes at most. So it goes to show you that there's always an effort by the establishment to play with the marginal vote. They have this way of swinging elections, and you know it's a shame that you know you have to fight this hard for people to have an opportunity to just govern themselves. But the old guard, the establishment, they don't want to let go, and they're going to continue to fight and contest our democracy to manipulate it to their advantage.
Well, it was interesting because Danielle Brown, she eclipsed everybody. She got like about almost 2,200 votes last I saw. Mm-hmm. But then everybody else, much different, so close. It was almost gut-wrenching to see. I mean, Caitlin Gleason at 1,700 and
mm-hmm.
Andre Wallace at 1,690. I mean, And that's a very, very close, that's a very close race. It's actually 26 votes separating them.
Right.
Andre Wallace is the old guard. And Lauren Carter is the old guard.
Right.
And Janet Duarte is the old guard. Looks like they're not going to make it. Delia Ferguson, I was shocked, you know, the least of them.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know who Nicole Lucio is, but I never heard of her name before.
Right.
But she's way off the deep end there at 6%. So what does this tell us, though?
What it tells us is that the people of Mount Vernon really want different. They want change, and they're tired of the same old, same old. And what we're seeing is a rejection of recycling these, you know, old, dead ideas of running a municipality. And that's a good thing. You know, it's time for fresh energy. It's time for new ideas, and it's time to really just, you know, move forward by looking through the front window and not driving this you know, bus, looking to drive it through the rearview mirror, which is so much smaller and virtually impossible. So I just know that, you know, Mount Vernon has a tremendous opportunity to move the city in a direction where it can get substantial and significant change if this new team can hold on and withstand the legal challenge to undo the election results right now.
Yeah, but when you use like the legal thing, terms like legal challenge, do people understand what this legal challenge is and where it's coming from?
No, and that's where a lot of people don't understand that when you have elections, unless you have an overwhelming tsunami of people come out to vote you in, it's very, very, it creates an opportunity for discretion to be used by the Board of Elections to eliminate certain votes, to reject some votes, and to use technicalities to narrow the margin so that a winner is hard to declare, and they rely on the courts to kind of, you know, determine the result of the election. And you saw that play out when I had my petition process where, you know, the judge on the first day said she wanted to hear our evidence. And then when we got into court 2 days later, she said, I don't want to hear your evidence. And that's where it becomes very tricky with court, because the courts can do almost anything they want because they're the ones interpreting the law. And
you know what's so interesting about that? People don't understand, and I am in shock. I saw police departments endorse judges, police departments, and yet those are the people who preside in a courtroom that may have to judge whether the police did something right or did something wrong, whether they abided by the law and the standards that are demanded of them. That's why they took the job. So they have to abide by what they said they would do. Why are we even permitting that? Isn't there something wrong when we permit police to endorse, even through a union? Why is that acceptable?
Well, you know, the endorsement process is the only signal you have as a public official to show, you know, what positions you will likely advance. So for the police to endorse a judge means that judge favors the police. And if a judge were endorsed by, let's say, a tenants' rights group, it's likely that judge would lean toward interpreting the law toward a tenants' rights group. So it is a challenge, especially when it comes to judges being endorsed, because it signals that they may be a bit biased. Judges are not supposed to be biased. The law is supposed to be blind. But we all know that there are biases in the system. So I look at the situation right now in Mount Vernon as, despite the low voter turnout, people were determined to reject failed politicians, failed past practices. They rejected the toxic elements that the old guard relies on to try and divide and win elections. So I just hope that the legal challenge that's underway right now, I hope that the old guard is not successful in stealing this election from the people. That's my hope.
Well, yeah, one would hope that whoever is supposed to be sitting and presiding over this final count will recognize that the vote is the vote. And I don't know where it could have gone wrong. You know, I never understand how you could throw out all these votes even though there may be only a 50-point or 20-point difference between them, it's so close, and the political operatives in so many of these oversight committees, they undermine the whole process. But I'm amazed that some people really lost badly. Look at that race for comptroller. I mean, Marcus Griffiths at 17%,
yep.
Derrickson Lawrence at 21%, and Darren Morton blew the whole thing right out the water with 62%. He was supported by the mayor. So I think she's got a lot to going for her here, assuming that, you know, the Caitlin Gleason and Danielle Brown and Edward Poitier, if they survive, then, I mean, they did the work. I mean, she gave the, I guess, not overt, but covert endorsement. So that's where it went. She may just be getting into her stride at this point if those people survive.
So I want to echo what you said and point out that there were a lot of people, including myself, that made it very public. We believe in new, and you know, I made it a point to express my support for Darren Morton in multiple different ways, going back to as early as mid-May, and uh-huh. I'm glad that people responded positively to that. And also with the new team, the forward team, I was very, very deliberate and strategic in advocating for them, because, you know, we've seen what Wallace and Duarte and Delia Farquharson has done. And when you look at the raw sewage backed up in people's homes throughout Mount Vernon, and you go back in time and look at how each of them voted, including Marcus and Lisa, they all voted against repairing the sewers in the city. So they are largely responsible for the problems we have today. And they also...
Well, that was the thing about Lisa Copeland. I was shocked that she was running for, for county board legislator? She would still... I don't know if she did that well on that or not.
No,
she failed that.
She lost to Ty Ray, who, again, represents new ideas, new energy.
Right, right. She was running against Ty Ray, and he won. He blew it out the water, which is terrific for him. I think that was wonderful.
He was another candidate that I got behind. You know, I even have his lawn sign on my lawn. And
uh-huh.
I just want to be clear that, you know, these people, Lisa Copeland, Marcus Griffith, Andre Wallace, Janice Duarte, Delia Farquharson, they all voted to defund the police. And
yeah.
And
now we don't have enough police officers in Mount Vernon. They're leaving.
And they don't have the equipment. These five people refuse to hold the city comptroller accountable, not just when I was in office, but even to this day, they don't want to hold the comptroller accountable. So it goes to show you that they showed who they really are to the people. And the people assessed their performance and said, we don't want to deal with do-nothing people, because that's all they've done is nothing. So I'm hopeful. I'm going to maintain cautious optimism that the forward team is going to hang on, because when you really look at the root of all the toxic, negative elements in Mount Vernon's politics, it comes from a very small sect within the old guard, and it's largely connected to Andre Wallace and his crew. And that's where you have to know, like, look, that's unnecessary. I think given the world pandemic, right, that went on, given all the challenges our kids have having to get caught up on education, given the safety issues, like my nephews were shot a couple weeks ago. Thank God they're alive. One of them graduated yesterday and performed an amazing performance despite being, you know, injured from being shot. And it just, you know, their plea, the plea of the youth is, give us something to do, make us safe, give us places to go, give us work, give us opportunities, get these guns off the streets, But you can't do that if you don't have police. You can't do that if you don't have a city government that's going to function. And that's the issue that I believe the voters responded to when they had their chance to vote. And it's clear to me by the actions of the old guard that they don't want to let go. They really want to keep Mount Vernon in the past. And I'm hoping and praying that the courts reject the old guard's latest move to undo the election.
I want to ask you one last thing again about Lisa Copeland. So since she lost to Tyree, does that mean this will be the end of her term? It'll end at this year as city council person?
No. Lisa has two more years left.
Oh, she's got two more years. So she'll still be on?
Mm-hmm. With Derek
okay,
Thompson.
Sorry?
She'll be on with Councilman Derek Thompson. So the two of them.
Okay, so then how many? So
there are five seats total.
Right. That's what I wasn't sure. I thought it was four. Okay, so there are five seats total. Okay. So then the forward team could conceivably, if they outlast the challenges, they could be the other three. Okay.
Right. And that would definitely, shift Mount Vernon into a higher gear. And and open for that because, when you think about the missed opportunities and you think about, Mount Vernon being trapped in this donut hole, we're in the center of this donut hole where all the other municipalities are rising, literally rising. New Rochelle, Yonkers, White Plains, even to the south in the Bronx, rising up. And Mount Vernon is just in this circle watching everybody, go up, and we're still in the basement. We have so much history here. We have so much to offer. And it doesn't have to be this broken and this busted. There's too much potential. And we also pay the highest taxes of the cities. We pay the highest cost in the county, which inevitably means we pay the highest taxes in the country. And it doesn't, the services and the situation doesn't reflect that. We should have a better quality of life than Bronxville, but we don't. And that's where I'm hoping that a new group of people get into office that will just do the work and let Mount Vernon grow into becoming the great city it truly is.
Mm-hmm. It would be nice for them to recapture the old glory because I don't know how long it's been waning, but it hasn't moved forward. Well, you're in politics. You were the mayor, and are you going to consider entering the political fray? You may not be now going into elected office because they precluded that in the primary, before the primary. What are your prospects? I mean, how are you going to stay involved? Do you still have a very good name?
Thank you. Thank you. And this last effort to, put my name forward for office, when I went to go and vote, a lot of the people said they were looking for my name on the ballot, and I had to explain to them that, they took us into court and put us into this impossible position, and it was very expensive to fight, and that's how they manipulate democracy. They do it through the courts. That's what we see right now. So my objective in the future of Mount Vernon is it does not involve public office at this point in time. I don't believe I'll be a candidate for office for a very long time if we can get the city accomplishing its true goals and objectives. So and that's where when you look at a team and you look at the roles of a team, the best leader is the best follower. And that's where I continue to emphasize, I have no problem following anybody's lead so long as they're going in the right direction. Today, you have to question that leadership because, just the other day somebody was killed, somebody was shot and fighting for their life in broad daylight, and the city's not looking at from the police department standpoint, there are major problems there that need to be addressed. So without a correction in the police department, it's going to be very hard for anybody to get, you know, a second chance at staying in office if they're not going to keep the people safe. So I'm hoping that...
You know, well, they can't keep them safe if they don't have, they don't have the gasoline filled in their cars and they can't go out there. And there's a lot of gun violence that is, I don't know, has been exacerbated by the crisis of COVID-19 and other issues, lack of employment and so many other things. And people are desperate for food and for housing. And it all comes to a crescendo. And then a lot of people are leaving Mount Vernon as police officers. I don't know where they're going specifically, but you're losing good police officers who have the training and the knowledge of the community. Is that happening everywhere in Westchester County?
It's happening in a outlier way in Mount Vernon. I mean, the lost over 50 cops, from what I understand, and that's a big number. You're losing a lot of institutional knowledge, a lot of senior people that understand how to engage with the public. And while it is good to have new cops, the challenge you have is if they don't understand the city, it invites tension and it invites a possible situation to get out of control unnecessarily. Mm-hmm. So you need the insight of the more experienced officers to stay there to help guide the new ones as they, you know, transition out. But losing 50 cops in a matter of a year is an extraordinary number, and it signals that there's a tremendous problem with the leadership of the department. And that's where I hope that...
What are there, about 350 cops in Mount Vernon? Or 300?
No, it was 210.
Oh, that's all. Now, or was that before?
No, so it was 210. That was the one of the peak numbers. I got it back up to 170, actually 150, and I got it back up to 210 before I left. And since then, you lost over 50 officers, and that's again a signal that there's a problem with the leadership. And I hope that the leadership really takes the feedback from the community and the public very more seriously, because again, the guns were not as prevalent, and you can't blame COVID as an excuse. You just can't. When you look at
you can blame unemployment, which was the residue that was left behind.
Unemployment.
Are there enough jobs?
But unemployment is also not a complete excuse either, because you have access to millions of federal dollars. You have access to resources, be it food pantries, mental and social health services. You have all these things that can help address the issue. It's just if you're not deploying them in the right fashion, you're going to allow these bad situations to get worse. And that's where I'm just saying, look, adjustments need to be made.
So who's responsible for it? Is there anybody responsible for this to come about?
Well,
or is it just a generic?
The people that are using the illegal guns are ultimately responsible. But those people need to be discouraged, they need to be engaged, and they need to be addressed in a very aggressive fashion. We can look at bail.
But why are the police leaving?
So the police leaving is a result of a combination of factors. One, you know, their contract has not been respected and honored. The city controller has not taken any action to honor their contract whatsoever.
Right.
And that's across the board. The city controller has refused to repair the police vehicles that have been broken. And if you go to some of the repair shops along McQuesten Parkway, you'll see mountains of police cars just sitting there that need to be in the street. But this, again, goes back
to... So the bottom line is that financially the city doesn't have the capacity to do anything about it because of the controller.
I disagree with that.
It's always which begs the question: then why is the legal system so slow? Because I blame the legal system for allowing this to come about. Because at the end of the day, can't govern if you can't govern, and you can't govern if there's no money, even though money's supposed to be collected. We don't even know what's in the coffer.
So
we have no idea what's going to be left there.
Well, let's unpack that, because this is where, you know, I want to come back to the city council. The city council has the ability.
Okay.
The city council has the ability to fix it with the mayor, but the two have refused to do that. And that's where I go back to.
You mean the two? You mean who? You mean the mayor refuses to do that? I didn't see that she refuses to do anything.
So
she doesn't get support from the city council.
So
the controller. You had the same problem.
Well, let's unpack it a little bit more. So
okay.
The city council and the mayor have held numerous board of estimate meetings declaring that the controller is incompetent, she's out of her mind, all sorts of profanities and insults going back and forth. They've done that for the past 2 years. And when it came to them addressing the city's bank, the city's financial institution that handles the money,
mm-hmm.
in the board of estimate, that is the institution that tells the city's bank what to do. The mayor and the council president have refused to direct the bank to do the work that needs to be done. That is the entity, not the controller.
Except that only a few weeks ago, Mayor Sean Patterson Howard was able to have another account opened up at another branch, another bank. So it's the beginning process, but look how long it took. I can't blame her for it. There was
no.
I don't know what capacity she had that she didn't incorporate.
You can't give a free pass.
What didn't she do?
You can't give a free pass, and here's why.
I don't give anybody a free pass, but
no,
I don't want to undermine somebody if they work 2 years,
yeah.
and this is the best they could do.
So let's just quickly, you know, untangle the issues so that people listening and watching and hearing this can understand that there was a deliberate choice by the executive branch and the city council to
mm-hmm.
not go to the bank to force the bank to do its job. That decision was made, and they went on the record explaining, like, oh, changing banks is not going to solve the problem. You know, it's just a political theater. It's a distraction. And then all of a sudden, they go that direction. They open up a new account, and things start to happen. But then the court steps in
right.
and says, slow down, wait a minute. This process needs to be revisited because the city charter calls for a certain approach with respect to these specific funds. And for a lot of people, it's easy to get confused on how the government works and how there are different rules to different agencies and different entities within the government.
Mm-hmm.
So what I want to focus on is the $21 million. It is supposed to go through the city controller. That's what the charter calls for those funds. And the Board of Estimate is the determining factor of how those funds are allocated, distributed, utilized. The controller's role, yes, she is supposed to process the paperwork. But if the Board of Estimate makes a direction, Hezzy, and to all those out there listening, specific to these funds, I'm not talking about any other agency, just within the construct of the charter, the federal funds in this regard are supposed to go through the controller's office and then be distributed to different agencies. The bank plays a role in that process.
No, I understand that, but then with the Chase account,
uh-huh.
That still listens to the controller at present.
That's the problem. I'm sorry for jumping in right there.
Well, that's the problem. But then,
right.
But the bank, evidently in your case and evidently in this case, are not going to relinquish the whatever funds they have over at the Chase Bank. So if I were Mount Vernon, I would sue them from here to Kingdom Come. There would be no end to this case. I would break Chase Manhattan to the ground. There would be nothing left.
That is what is supposed to happen now. The law department.
So what they did was illegal. What they did at Chase was illegal because they didn't accept the regulation that they needed two digital signatures for the checks to be dispersed, or the money to be dispersed. She was doing it on her own.
That's right. And you just nailed it. The bank needs to be held accountable, and that's where the city council and the mayor, they have not held the bank accountable. And that's where they can go back in time and, like you said, sue the bank. They should sue the bank going back to 2016 because the bank
behaved. I hear what you're saying is right, but then why was that not able to be accomplished when you were in office? What's the difference?
The evidence was not ready. The truth takes time, and that's one of the key things that I learned from being in office. Like, the truth takes time to come out. And lies are so much easier to believe, and they're more entertaining than the truth. The truth is tough. It's hard.
Mm.
But the truth remains that, you know, I got all the court orders. I proved that there was something, dubious going on. And by the time, 4 years went through, it was too late. So this administration...
Well, that's what I'm saying, too. It's not that I think that you did anything wrong. I think you were going in the right direction, but the time that it took also caused a lot of people to lose, support for you. And the same thing happened with Sean Patterson Howard, because she's been in office now, what, is it a year and a half now?
It's just about.
About a year and a half. But in that year and a half, she started from scratch when she got elected, and she went through the same process. She asked the state government to help. They didn't. She asked the comptroller to help. He didn't. She asked Lefkowitz, the judge in White Plains. She didn't. Everywhere she went, and it all failed because nobody wanted to correct the error. And they all knew what the error was. And
right.
You even went to the bank in Mount Vernon, and I thought they were going to arrest you.
Yep.
But because you were the mayor, they knew who you were, but they didn't want to hear it. And they thought that they could probably push you around, and this way they were able to hold on to the account.
You summarize it perfectly, but I still want to just come back to the Board of Estimate and Contract, because the mayor and the council president, they have the legal authority to take action within the bank on the bank's contract with the city. It takes two signatures, and the bank already made.
So why haven't they? I don't understand the rationale. Then why haven't they?
That's the question that only the mayor and the council president can answer. And that's why, when you look at the issues,
the Board of Estimate includes the mayor as well as the city council president?
Correct, and the comptroller.
Okay, so, the comptroller, we know she's out of it. She's not going to do anything to facilitate any of this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So it was up to Lisa Copeland and Sean Patterson Howard, and if they are the only two of the three, can they function on their own?
Yes, they can.
Two of them, Lisa Copeland and Sean Patterson Howard, and they could move it over?
Now, it's the mayor and Marcus Griffith as council president. So you just, again, look at the dynamic, see that you have someone.
Marcus Griffith has been one of the problems that stood in the way.
That's correct. And that's how you.
It's not the mayor. You know, look.
Tell me.
Everybody needs to be responsible for this. But at the end of the day, I'm sorry, I got confused with Lisa and Marcus Griffith there. But the point is that Marcus Griffith, then he's not doing the job, and there's no way to get around him. because the mayor can't do it on her own. And and the comptroller didn't want to get involved with probably either one of them.
So
the whole thing is a failure. And I still don't understand why, look, at one time there was a request to even have the control board come in. But now it makes no reason, because it took all that time to await this process now to take place where, you know, supposedly they have now a new account and they can get rid of the Chase account by the end of the year.
So hopefully they
when the controller will be out.
Yeah, hopefully they can transition away and get with a new relationship with a new bank that's going to take Mount Vernon more serious. But, Ezzy, I just want to go back in time very briefly. I'm going to have to look for the links to show you in the words, in their own words, both President Griffith and the mayor. They both spoke on this issue at length and gave their own rationale as to why they did not want to take this step in holding the bank accountable. And then they reversed that position to then create a new account for the federal monies, and then they got slapped back by the court saying that those monies have to go a different route because that's what the law calls for. So they're still back at the position that you just described. Like, Marcus is a big part of the problem. I just want to emphasize that if you look very carefully at the terms and conditions of the banking contract between the city of Mount Vernon and the bank, it lays out very clearly that the mayor and the council president can administer the funds the same way the controller is supposed to. If those two signatures...
Okay, you know, I can't argue with that because you know then the law and the standard with regard to that. I guess what concerns me is that they may not have, maybe Marcus and the mayor didn't know how this was supposed to work, but shouldn't there be any oversight committee within the government that would have been able to afford to tell them how it's supposed to work?
Bingo.
I don't know if Marcus Griffiths is an expert in banking, and I don't know if the mayor is.
Let's shift to that point.
I mean, I'm not going to blame them but ignorance is not bliss.
Right.
Somebody should have been able to tell them what was going wrong.
So let's just focus very briefly on that aspect of the financial transparency part. I started an initiative, and it was successful in changing the city charter. It was successful in getting transparency strengthening transparency in the city charter, making it law and a requirement.
Mm-hmm.
The controller has not fulfilled her obligation under those new charter revisions. And the city council has refused to hold her accountable. If they wanted to, they could hold her in violation of the city charter and remove her from office for that offense, for not producing the finances that the voters of Mount Vernon voted overwhelmingly for. But then I come back to this point.
I understand. That's why I never understood why they didn't get rid of her and why they kept on punting over to whether it be Lefkowitz on the court or whether it was DiNapoli. If it could have all been done, why didn't they do it? I don't understand what they were waiting for.
And that's why I'm saying, look, there's obviously some larger, issue in the background that we don't know about. And quite frankly, I'm optimistic with a new group of public officials. We may be able to get beyond that issue that's holding Mount Vernon back. We may be able to get, out of our own way and just let the past stay in the past. So for all those people watching and questioning, like, why am I spending a lot of time talking about these issues, I'm talking about them only because I want to provide context as to what the issue is, what the dynamics involve, but I really want to get to the solution. The solution is for the government to function. And if the government functions, then, there shouldn't be this amount of drama or controversy. We don't need the drama. We have enough drama in life as it is. So
yeah, but when we look at it from the time that you got into office to the time you left till the time there was another, temporary mayor, interim mm-hmm. mayor, and then now we have another mayor now. So we're looking at a span now of about 5.5 years.
Yep.
And the question is Mount Vernon ready to pull the lever and get it done? And even the forward Mount Vernon Forward group, are they aware of what they can do or cannot do? What's her name? Deborah Reynolds is not Deborah Reynolds. She's not going to be there. She's not running for re-election.
Right.
But she'll be here till the end of the year, in another 6 months. What's going to happen when the new team gets in? They'll have another controller. Well, that'll be Mr. Morton. I think he's a reverend, though. So, so hopefully he'll be aware, and maybe they'll all work together. Is government all personalities? Is that it?
They hate you,
they love you.
I think that there's a lot of personal ego problems in the way. That's for certain. But what I do want to just point to is fixing what's broken is possible. And fixing what's broken, not as difficult as it appears. All we have to do is have a group agree. And what we have is, and as you already pointed out, we have people in office right now that are not doing the work that they're supposed to do. And so my role, my goal in speaking on these issues is to hopefully encourage the public to ask more questions, encourage the public to urge action, because the public benefits. I mean, we're in this tough spot. We can get out if we just say we're going to focus on safety. Once it's safe, then we're going to create jobs, and then once we create jobs, we're going to have tax revenue, and the next thing you know, prosperity is back. So
what's interesting? I don't see it I'm not questioning what's happening in Mount Vernon, but I know, for example, in the city of Yonkers, you don't get any press notices for anything that goes on in government. The police never tell you what the crime rate is. You don't hear from one department or the next department, and it's all done in silence. And then, years later, you find out, well, didn't you know about this and didn't you know about that? What am I? I'm not a clairvoyant, and nobody else is either. And the ones that are kept in the loop are kept in the loop. But the point is that the public is not kept in the loop.
Right.
I'm not concerned about me. I have enough stories to write that will keep me going till I'm 150, which I won't last that long. But the bottom line is the public is the one that's being kept in the dark. So how do you change the demeanor or the function of government where they have an interest in actually telling the public what's going on? Because you don't always see that.
I think for Mount Vernon, we need more voices like yours, like mine, to ask the substantive questions, the questions of, what's going to make it better? What actions need to happen to fix the problem? And you can pick a problem. It could be potholes. It could be sidewalks. Mm-hmm. It could be parks. It could be sports for kids.
Mm-hmm.
We need to just set an agenda and go down that agenda. And that's where I believe, in the wake of the building collapsing in Miami, in Florida.
Florida, yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Tragedy.
Yep.
This is what – it's a terrible tragedy that, over the years it's going to be studied very closely. People are going to look at it and say, oh, this could have been avoided if. And it could have been avoided if government would have acted. And just because people, the warnings were issued that the ground – underneath that building was eroding because of
mm-hmm.
something going on with the seawater. And the steel and the concrete was failing. But nobody acted strong enough to say, fix it. address it, do something about it. They just said, no, the building's going to stand, no big deal. But that threat is real, you know, with coastal communities. It is real. Mm-hmm. And that's where the latest infrastructure package from President Biden, this is an opportunity, right, to say, all right, here comes federal money to address failing infrastructure. And we know what it is in Mount Vernon, it's sewers. In Long Beach, Long Island, it might be buildings like the one we saw in Florida, right?
Mm-hmm.
They got to take a percentage of that money and then use a large percentage of that money to fund the repair of these failing infrastructure, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then you have own money, you know, so it could be 80-20, 20% of the local money, 80% of the federal money. But we have to do it and know that it will create jobs and it will keep people safe. So unless there's political
We also have to train people in these jobs because there are no jobs being created by circumstance, and we should focus in on that. I don't really see much of a template for employing more people other than, you know, for $8 an hour, $9 an hour at a supermarket. That's not enough. You can't pay rent on that alone. Forget about food.
And that's why I'm saying, like, you have to have a very strategic agenda. You have to have the political will to achieve that agenda. And that's where I hope that this new team holds on to do that. And I hope that, you know, Tyree, who's our county legislator, continues to take on these new challenges, but know that there's a group of people that has, you know, the interest of the people at heart and taxpayers' concerns at heart, and we want to see Mount Vernon succeed. And we're not going to be prepared.
In order for them to succeed, they're going to have to be vocal. They're going to need to be able to reach out to the public, not just in their meetings. Are they going to do that? They have to make a decision that this is the way they're going to be open and welcoming of the public.
Huh?
And this has to be done. And if they don't, they're going to fail. The city fails too.
Right. And that's where I am. I'm saying, look, I'm making a very conscious decision, right, to make it clear that the most powerful thing to do is to let go of power and try to empower other people to do the work that needs to be done. And that's what I've always done. If you look very carefully at many of the actions that I've taken, it's always been, here's the problem, here's the solution, how do we work together to achieve this? But as you pointed out, and I pointed out, for the past, you know, 5.5 years, everybody said no, from the state controller on down. So now it's a new group, new city council, hopefully the election results stick, new controller coming in. Hopefully they just say, okay, enough is enough. Let's just fix the park. Let's make a new recreation center. Let's put in a community pool. Let's make Mount Vernon cool again. Let's do it. And I would be so excited for that, because then it's like, you know, I don't have to worry about being shot going to the gas station trying to get ice cream and cookies like my nephew did. So
exactly.
I just want to see it.
How do you set these things right? So evidently, I don't know if your nephew would not have been shot if there were the 50 cops that have left of recent days or weeks or months would still be there. Or wouldn't have been hit because there were more cops on the street or doing their function. Or even when they were still working, there was no gasoline to put in the car. So there was a slow response no matter what.
So,
but how do you get them all to work so that it functions?
So let me speak very briefly. So when there was no gas, the cops rode bikes and they walked. And so I point that I was going to back the blue and make sure to try and keep their morale boosted. And I moved heaven and earth to make sure that they could get access to the gas and the supplies that they needed. And we were very successful in fighting and winning those fights for safety and for the people. So even now, I firmly believe that if the same amount of respect would have been given to the work that the police do, and if the leadership led the way they should, we wouldn't have the badge drain that we have. And we need to really carefully examine, you know, the impacts of defunding the police and demoralizing them, because, you know, having only two police officers for the city at nighttime is unacceptable.
Mm-hmm.
So it sets the tone.
Yeah, absolutely.
The criminals know that bail reform protects them, and the criminals know that the cops are outnumbered. So they're going to take their shot because the tone is not the right tone. But if City Hall were to really take the fight to crime and attack it the way it should, then you'll see a different tone happen. Now, Biden, this is – and look, I'm a Democrat, but I don't subscribe to some of the classic, you know, hits of Democratic approach to certain policies. They want to throw more money at the problem. Oh, here's more money. Throw more money at it. I'm saying, wait a minute. Let's examine the operations. Let's look at management. Let's make some adjustments with what we have. And if we need more money, we'll ask for it, but we'll know why we want it.
Yeah, but, you know, again, you can't blame Biden because he's got all these operatives that work within the system and been working there for the last 30 or 40 years, and they're not saying a word.
So,
you know, he
so
says, we need to do this, we need to do that. And their job is to get it done, and they bring the package forward. Nobody even has a clue what's in there, and it gets passed, and then we find out it's a failure. But you, in the meantime, you spent $1 trillion, and it sounds great. But
right.
The question is it sufficient?
Funny,
and
the
is it appropriate? He wanted $3 trillion, and the Republicans wouldn't go for it. So, okay, he worked out some sort of an agreement, and this was the best that he could do at the moment. What about ramifications for messing up, like Deborah Reynolds? Is she going to go to jail? Because I don't think she should be allowed to go home.
Well, look, I have very strong feelings on that. I have very strong opinions on that, and I think that there's a lot of moving parts on that one that we'll have to spend another show to go
over.
But I will say that I have a different, more business-minded approach to solving problems when it comes to public administration. I believe that everything we need, we just need to, you know, work better together. And if we can use the resources that we do have, we should use it strategically, and we don't have to constantly have the aggravation and the drama. That's where I'm coming from when I say, when I unpack all these issues for people to understand, it's not a criticism. These are the facts. This is how it is. So my objective in explaining it is hoping to get people to understand that, you know, we've been sold a bill of goods, and they're not good. So we can fix it by confronting it, and that's where truth is. Truth is in the center of that conflict. And that's where, I look at my nephew, right? He's 18 years old, going to college, honor student, doesn't go outside that much. Finally decides to go to a party, comes home, gets shot on his way home. Like, that's not the Mount Vernon I want. That's not the Mount Vernon I wanted. That's why I fought so hard to make Mount Vernon much better, much
safer.
But
when you look at that circumstance that happened to your nephew, and then what are the reasons it happened? It happens because the police department is failing. It happens because people are leaving the department. It happens because the funding isn't available when it needed to be, and that, again, falls on the back of the controller. And then how do you resolve this if you decided to leave by not running again? Because I think, who knows, if she would have run, maybe she would have gotten reelected. I don't know.
One viewer said that, you know, it's getting out of hand, and they're right. I go back to what we were discussing earlier. The city council president and the mayor have the power to address the bank and move the money as expeditiously as possible because they have those legal rights to do so. And if the bank...
Do they have the right to take the money out of Comptroller Reynolds?
They do. They have
right now?
They do. They
right
always,
now?
They, oh, yes, they have it right now.
Okay,
always
well, they,
had,
they always did, but they didn't. So the question is then, you know, why was... You know, I really resent this. Why did this not happen in this discussion up to this particular contest? Why did nobody bring this up? What
well,
is
we
wrong
did. No,
with
no,
the
we
system
did.
That people don't... They, I didn't hear it.
Okay.
And I didn't hear it.
And I'm gonna send you a clip. I'm gonna look for the clip of when the Board of Estimate responded to some of the comments that we made, and how, you know, one day they were like, oh, we're gonna go try and change banks, we're just gonna try it out, and then the next day they were praising the city comptroller. So there's obviously some political counterweight back there that's telling them to back off. So whoever that political counterweight is, you know, that's who.
Well, we need to find out, because that political counterweight is going to be the ruin of the city, whoever
right.
he or she may be.
Right. I'm saying, group. Look, we as a city need to win this election to reject the old guard handpicked candidates, and we have to, you know, hope and pray that the courts do not allow the heavy hand of the old guard to, you know, bias justice and to tilt the scales of justice the wrong way. We need justice in Mount Vernon for the people. There have been too many conflicts, too many problems that are completely unnecessary. And that's where, again, I'm hoping that this new team wins, and that's why I threw
well, you're, my support. You're 100. Those three people don't win, and they get challenged by whatever power that be that will dismiss one of those three. Then we're back to the same old game, aren't we?
And
is that
that's,
a controller?
And
who may not listen, and you don't have an override.
And that's where we have
and
to...
And you can
just,
change it to a fourth bank and a fifth bank, and it won't matter at all.
Well, let's not lose hope. Let's keep focused. I'm going to remain determined to help Mount Vernon build positively. And no matter who's in office, I'm going to do my best to convince them to make a decision that's best for people, best for the people of the city. And that's where I'm hoping that by talking through these issues, you know, the public officials, you know, understand that this is a privilege, and we can get it right. We just have to agree to stop getting it wrong. And that's where it's very recognized that they're part of the problem when they can become the solution. And that's where I hope my role being an outsider to saying, look, guys, come on. We tried this. It didn't work. What's the harm in trying a new approach that will result in a better outcome? And you know what? Hopefully they finally take those olive branches to work together. But if they don't, they have to know that the facts are going to be discussed. And that's where I've always come from. I've always discussed issues in people in their positions based on those facts. Never anything personal.
Well, I hope at the end of the day, because you're going to stay focused on being on the subject matter, because I don't think there's been enough discussion. I don't think there are enough people in the city that are aware of it. And as long and hopefully there's nothing really to discuss other than to applaud, you know, success and
right.
a new demeanor. So that will be terrific. But if not, I hope you'll stick to it and discuss the remedies that we should have accomplished already, which we evidently haven't. So there's still hope. So the,
don't keep
the door
hope alive.
Is closing, but I hope
we're
going to
get it right. You watch. We're going to get it right.
All right. Well, we are coming to the end, so I want to thank you for making the time. I hope I haven't been too adversarial here.
No. Like I said, you know, we haven't. Couple of weeks, we've been trying to call in, and I've been having issues getting through to your show, so I'm excited that, you know, we finally get to talk through the issues that have been pent up for so long.
Exactly. That's true, too. All the best. I hope your nephew is feeling better and recuperating well and not traumatized by it all. So all the best to you. Have a great weekend, sir.
Thank you. And happy 4th of July, Ron. Bye.
And you, too. All the best. So a happy 4th of July greeting. You heard it first from the former mayor of Mount Vernon, Richard Thomas, and we'll speak to you on Monday. So all the best, and thank you for being with us today. Goodbye.